This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
What's the bare minimum you expect from your workplace? Obviously, to get paid, a bit of respect. What about a toilet? Because women across Australia, particularly tradies, are saying too often they've got nowhere to go. So how is this happening? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, you're going to hear from some tradies about their experiences.
There was no other toilets on site and I wet my pants. I was very embarrassed and very scared as well.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this is something you've been through, maybe in another industry. No facilities for women. You've got no options. Message in 0439 757 555. Also ahead, we're going to have the latest on a new international public health emergency. Should Australia be worried about this? First, though.
Hack.
We aren't going to be competitive in comparison to major companies. I'm a musician. I'm not a finance bro.
Triple J.
What do we have to do to save live music in this country? Big question, I know, and to be honest, it's been asked quite a few times. It's been a big focus over the past couple of years. There was a big federal government inquiry into live music a couple of years ago. We talked about that on Hack. Then the states had their own. South Australia had a big inquiry. Victoria's Parliament looked into live music venues last year. Now New South Wales has kick-started its own investigation into the state of live music. So are they all just hearing the same thing? And is anything actually changing? What do you think needs to be the biggest priority when it comes to saving live music in this country? Message in. I'm keen to hear from you. 0439 757 555. We're going to hear from people right across this sector today. But first, Jackson Worthington with a bit of an update on the inquiry.
I'm not a musician because I earn money. I'm a musician because of the years of practice that I've spent, the thousands of...
Earlier today, the live music industry descended on a committee room in New South Wales Parliament. On the agenda, insurance, government grants, monopolies and young musos not being paid.
We are the primary producers of the music industry.
Alexander Poirier was one of the witnesses. He's a musician and the president of the musician section of the Media Entertainment Arts Alliance in New South Wales. Mia says 44% of artists still report making less than $250 a gig, and the average professional musician is earning only about 15 grand a year.
There are a lot of examples of venues and companies saying you'll get this amount of money if you sell enough tickets. There are so many examples of young musicians paying to perform.
The inquiry into the state of live music in New South Wales has received more than 100 submissions. It's examining whether the changes the government has made in the past few years have made a difference. Those changes include a fairer system for managing noise complaints, funding for venue infrastructure, the extension of trading hours with incentives to host more gigs, the scrapping of lockout laws, and changes to application processes to make it easier to put on small shows.
The reforms work to enable councils and the private sector to build the stable foundation for going out behaviours to occur.
Mike Rodriguez is New South Wales 24-hour economy commissioner.
In broad terms, the overall performance is relatively solid and consistent. We've done a lot of work to put those stages in. The performances are happening, so it's been a positive outcome.
The New South Wales government has also implemented Michael's Rule, a policy which incentivises touring acts to pick Aussie artists as openers. Mia support that policy being extended, but Alex reckons it only helps a small number of acts because it's hard for young musicians to get to the level needed to go on those tours.
People can't kind of get to the level to be booked. Well, we have pubs, we have massive stadiums. There's just that missing bridge to allow people to actually grow.
Our venues are not simply pubs with bands in the corner.
Mark Gerber is one of the founders of the Live Music Venues Alliance, a group which represents independent venue owners across Australia. Mark also runs a venue in Sydney.
Live music's not only culturally valuable, it's economically significant.
He thanked the New South Wales government for the work it's already doing, but warned rising operational costs, changing consumer behaviour and insurance premiums are putting venues at risk.
We believe dedicated live music venues should be recognised similarly to galleries, libraries and theatres.
In the past few years, countless music venues across Australia have had to close their doors, while festivals have struggled to stay afloat, with lots disappearing for good. Mark Gerber says there needs to be a focus on creating a sustainable music sector. He wants targeted rebates, fair operating conditions, and support to develop local talent and audiences.
We should not become renters with the global music industry. We should strive to be landlords.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting there, and some messages coming through. Someone says pokey machines killed live music, that person saying. Another person saying we need to get rid of some of those big multinationals. Is that person's opinion? Well, look, let's talk with someone in the industry now. And with us is Adele Robinson. Now, Adele is the managing director at Fuzzy, which puts on big events around the country. But she's also chair of the Australian Festival Association, which is a peak group representing festivals, as you can imagine. Adele Robinson, thank you very much for joining us. I mean, the first question I think we all have is, what do you think needs to change to save live music in New South Wales, but also in Australia as a whole?
I think before I answer that, I'll just point to the fact that a couple of years ago, live music in New South Wales was in a dire state. Now I'd say it's in a fragile state. Okay. So there's been some improvements, but it is still far more expensive to produce events in New South Wales than anywhere else in Australia. And we are still seeing festivals falling over. And I think the other thing we really need to be investing in audience development.
That's interesting about things improving a little bit over the past few years. What do you put that down to?
I put that down to the vibrancy reforms the New South Wales government has brought through, the establishment of Sound New South Wales, the fact that we've got a 24-hour economy commissioner. There's been a lot of work to improve and address the lockout laws, what happened during COVID, the war on music festivals that happened with the last government. There's been a lot of work towards all those things, but we can't kind of stop. We've got to keep going.
And also changing audience behaviour, as you're saying, people feeling a lot more comfortable going out to big events and wanting to see live music again is obviously a huge factor as well. I mean, are you hopeful that this inquiry is going to lead to some really substantive change? Because, you know, there have been inquiries in the past, not just in New South Wales, in other parts of the country. How optimistic are you that we could see some real reform?
It's a good question. I think because we are with a current government that does seem to really care about arts and culture, I am hopeful that there will be thoughtful change. And I think a lot of the changes that have been brought in, you know, they've looked at things like how noise complaints are handled and how that can be addressed to help venues stay open, liquor licensing regulation, trying to make that easier for new operators. So a lot of the change has been really thoughtful and they have really listened to the industry. So I am hopeful.
The focus obviously is New South Wales, but you're speaking to Australia now. Do you think the problems, the lessons of New South Wales are important for other parts of the country as well?
100%. And I think, you know, if you look at Victoria 10 years ago, events and music were pumping down there. It's not so much the case anymore. So I think that when an industry and a government becomes complacent, things can go backwards really, really quickly. And I think that's a big message for the inquiry today. There's been a lot of money invested. There's been a lot done, but there's still a lot more to do.
Yeah, we're hearing a lot from people on the text line now. Someone saying, divorce the music industry from alcohol. Local shires and councils should open non-profit, non-alcohol live music venues, similarly to how they have at galleries, at art galleries. Yeah, interesting suggestions coming through on the text line. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese, speaking with the Australian Festival Association. Adele Robinson about this inquiry into live music in New South Wales. Adele, one of the other ideas that has been kicking around, not just recently, but for a little while now, is a levy that could be introduced, an extra dollar that people would pay for tickets to big concerts at stadiums and stuff like that, and that money would go back into grassroots venues and artists. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's a great idea, and I think the UK has shown that that can definitely work. And I think that that whole notion of the big end of town supporting the small end of town, it's a fantastic notion.
Is it consumers though that's supporting? Like if they're the ones who are paying more for tickets, because that's kind of the counter argument. People saying, well, is it music fans who are already struggling and finding tickets really expensive? Should they be the ones forking out, or should it be those multinationals?
Yeah, look, I wasn't the one who put forward this, so I'm not completely across all the parts of it. But I think there can be a compromise where it can be a mixture. I know there was reference to Olivia Dean with an upcoming tour that she's coming setting up, she's actually forking out the money for this. So there's various different models that can be looked at.
There would be some people listening to this chat now thinking, look, festivals and events have been offered support from governments in the past. Like, I know the New South Wales government forked out a bit of money last year, I think, and that went to a few festivals, including Blues Fest. Hasn't necessarily worked. Should the taxpayer be responsible for propping up events that aren't sustainable going forward?
It's a good question. I think, you know, I got that funding as well, and the reason that Field Day continued is because of that funding. So not all funding is always going to be perfect, but those shows did happen the year that they had that funding, and that meant that there are a lot of people employed, there are a lot of artists that got to play. But one of the things we are looking for, calling in for in the inquiry, is looking at more dedicated funding for new and up-and-coming promoters that are looking after festivals. And also, as I mentioned before, with the audience development, looking at under-18s being a real focus. So I think funding is really important, but I think that now we're in a phase where we need to look at it being a bit more targeted.
It sounds like what you're saying is, of course, money is welcome, but you can't just throw money at a problem and hope it'll go away. You need to be addressing some of these underlying issues.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having a chat with us. I really appreciate you coming in, Adele Robinson from the Australian Festival Association. Appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thanks so much.
And some similar messages coming through on the text line now. Someone saying governments can hold all the inquiries they want, but if the money is not being spent on investing in live music from supporting artists, venues, educational career pathways into those industries, then opportunities are going to be limited and too many people will struggle and they will not make it. Look, let's actually hear from some artists in New South Wales now to get a bit of an idea of what it is like to be a musician in that state. And joining me in the Hack studio is Egoism, a big name around Sydney for years, actually kicking off a national tour this weekend. Olive, Adam and Scout from Egoism, welcome to Hack.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So we've been hearing a lot about the live music scene in New South Wales. And as we've been hearing, there's this big inquiry underway now that's looking into some of the issues, the problems, and how we can address some of those. As performers right now, what's the biggest issue that's impacting the way you're performing and your ability to perform?
Look, I would say one of the issues, I guess, would be cost of living and the way that things are structured right now. It feels like artists are bearing the brunt of the cost of living crisis in terms of the entertainment industry.
Do you think things have got better or worse over the last few years?
It's hard to say. I think from our perspective, I think things have gotten a little bit better for us personally, but I can tell that as a whole, they've gotten worse, because it's just like all that I kind of hear about is like musicians of an older generation, and you can just kind of tell that they had like similar levels of success to us and were able to actually act on it more and like actually do more with it. I'm like, oh, you guys straight up were making money and spending less money. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just like Sydney costs more to live in, and also doing anything music related costs more. Like, think about the cost of petrol, thinking about every single thing that you have to pay for as an overhead as a musician has gone up. And then our income has not gone up because, well, guess who cost of living has gone up for, but all the listeners. And so they're not paying more for tickets. Often they're actually paying less because they can't really afford it. And then venues have gone up, and so our income has decreased.
I mean, Scout, you've got a day job as well. Is that hard to juggle the creativity and the joy that you get from music while also trying to make a living as well?
Well, yes. I work in disability as my day job, and luckily my workplace are great in terms of being very flexible with me when I need to take off time for music, but that was really hard to find a job like that. And it means that, like, today I went to work and I took off my shift early to come here to do an interview, and then I'm going straight back to work. And it's exhausting because I'm just constantly juggling lots of different things that I have to do, all these different segments of life. And I still have to worry all the time about money and where how I'm going to make it all work.
Do you think it's particularly bad in New South Wales and Sydney? Like, do you speak with other people in other parts of the country about what it's like?
I would say Brisbane, I think, is worse because it's higher costs than somewhere like Melbourne, but then there's less opportunities. Whereas Melbourne is like cheaper and you can kind of do a lot of stuff. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Mm. Do you feel like the hunger is there from audiences, that younger people particularly? You mentioned the cost of living, and yes, it is hard to afford to be able to go to gigs and stuff like that, but you're feeling maybe there is a bit of resurgence in interest of going to live music?
I mean, I'm out all the time, and it's like, I definitely feel like there's been a huge resurgence just in the past couple of years. But I mean, I saw this like statistic that was basically saying that foot traffic is up and spending is down. And I think that kind of sums it up, because I don't think a lot of people are going out for the sake of it. I think that our artistic communities are becoming more and more niche and more about like people who are enthusiasts for a specific art form, compared to maybe, I don't know, whatever time period in the past where it's like, you know, you go out to see a band, you don't really know who they are. Like, that is the night out. Mm. And so now we're kind of going to this world where you're either in it or you're out of it. Like, these are closed circles, and these closed circles are not sustainable because you have no way to actually induct new people into these kind of communities.
Interesting. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Olive, Adam and Scout from Sydney group Egoism, and we're talking about this live music inquiry in New South Wales and the state of live music, not only in New South Wales, but across the country right now. Hearing from you on the text line, someone says, you know, I'm in a band in Western Sydney. I feel like people forget that live music doesn't just exist in arenas or festivals. We just need to get the public to realise that these smaller venues do exist. Yeah, Adam, how do you feel when you're talking to younger people getting into the music industry, when you're talking about the reality of it, about what little money, I guess, you're making? Is it upsetting?
I think it's humbling. I think it's just humbling. I think it just... it kind of puts things into perspective, and that there isn't really an end goal or an idea of what success is within music. I think if it does exist, it should be something quite small, such as like, I have a dream of making an album that goes on a vinyl, or I have a dream of touring. Like, it doesn't have to be I'm making money exclusively off my music. And I think that's a much more enriching and fulfilling thing to be working towards rather than just money.
Have you all thought about, you know, quitting music because of financial pressures in the past? Is that something that's ever come up? Or do you know other people who have thought, I can't do this any longer?
I know quite a few musicians who've really pulled back. Yeah. I know so many great musicians who've left or just given up because they go, I can't do this anymore, I can't afford it. And I would say it's especially true with working class musicians or musicians who can't live with their parents, or maybe musicians who get sick or they want to have kids. You know, like you get to a certain age and you go, well, the cost of living is so great. I maybe want to buy a house one day, or I maybe want to have a child and be able to afford that. Okay, well, I can't really do that. Because like, it's actually a lot of work to be a musician. And I love that work. Like all three of us, we wouldn't be in this if we weren't extremely passionate, you know, but like it is a lot of hours. Like we put in so many hours all the time.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has like a niche band that just broke up or kind of faded away that you had this feeling of, what the hell? Like they could have been so big. Like I love them. I wish they were around. And like the reality is most of the time they did that because they weren't able to get their music to a position where it was like financially self-sustaining.
What's the hope like out of this inquiry, and then broadly, like looking forward 10, 15 years into the future, where would you like to see the music scene, not just in New South Wales, but in Australia more broadly?
I personally would like to see being an artist, and this is, goes beyond just being a musician, but being an artist as a life path that you can choose for your entire life that can be supported by the government. Or I would like to see an ecosystem where you are essentially choosing to be a musician. Like no one gets forced out of being an artist due to kind of financial pressures. Like you're making art because you want to make art every day.
Just quickly, any shows that you've got coming up so that people can support you if they want to support you?
I mean, yeah, come. We're about to go on tour for the whole country. So yeah, come to that. Sydney and
our Sydney show
Saturday?
Is all ages.
Olive, Adam, Scout from Egoism, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you do want to learn more about Egoism's tour, you can tune in to Home and Hosed with Anika Luna tomorrow night at about 7:45. Full chat there, talking all about their music, so make sure you tune into that. Hearing from you on the text line now, Mike in Newey says, there's been a focus on festivals for too long. Drop the price of alcohol and get people out seeing local bands at their local pub. Another person saying, how about look at the outrageous fees police are requesting in order for music festivals to go ahead. So many mid-sized events just can't afford what is being asked of them. And another person saying audience members want to be going to gigs, but when tickets are so highly priced, we have to pick and choose what we can afford to go to. It's changed a lot with the cost of living. All right, we're going to move on.
You're listening to Hack.
The World Health Organization has declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern.
On Triple J.
Yeah, only a few days ago we were telling you about hantavirus, but now another disease has the world very concerned, and that is Ebola virus. There's an outbreak in Central Africa, and the World Health Organization has actually declared it a public health emergency of international concern. And that's one of the highest risk assessments the WHO makes. So what exactly does it mean? And should Australia be worried? Well, Shalila Madour has been looking into it.
Currently, I'm on panic mode because people are dying. I don't have medicines. I don't have vaccine.
The Director General of Africa Centres for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Jean Kaseya, was pretty blunt about the impact of a new Ebola outbreak on the continent. At least 300 people have contracted Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda. At least 80 people are suspected to have died from the disease. Local health services have started preparing for numbers to increase.
We have identified a room where we are receiving patients. There are options being explored and spaces being prepared for the triage of patients and so that we can set up the treatment centres.
The outbreak started in the Ituri province of northeastern Congo.
Ituri and northern Kivus, they're heavily contested, multiple small militia groups. It's a mining area where the militia groups are trying to get access and win sort of currency in.
Dr. Ian Norton, who worked for the World Health Organization in setting up treatment centres in the region, says the location of the outbreak makes it difficult for health workers to treat the sick.
Extremely unstable, difficult place to work. I spent many weeks in there supporting the rebuilding of some treatment centres that had actually been attacked by local communities and had burnt out.
The virus has now spread to neighbouring Uganda, and the Congolese Health Minister, Samuel Roger Kamba, says misinformation about the virus has made the outbreak worse.
People in the community said it was witchcraft. Now we realise that the first person fell ill in late April and died. The body was repatriated to a nearby town. It was the return of this body to a mining area with a large population that caused the Ebola outbreak to escalate.
Ebola is a viral hemorrhagic fever, which affects your blood vessels and causes them to leak. It causes fever, headaches, and vomiting and diarrhea. As Professor Raina McIntyre from the Kirby Institute explains, it's highly contagious.
It spreads relatively easily through close contact, particularly with bodily fluids.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has had Ebola outbreaks before.
The DRC did have a very big epidemic with over 3,000 cases in 2018.
Nearly 2,300 people were thought to have died from that particular outbreak, which was caused by the deadly Zaire strain of Ebola. The Zaire strain can have a fatality rate of up to 90%. But as Dr. Kaseya says, it also has treatment options.
Fortunately, we have medicines and vaccines for the Zaire strain.
There's good news and bad news about the new outbreak.
We are dealing with a different strain. It's called the Bundibugyo strain.
This strain of Ebola isn't as deadly as the Zaire strain, though it still kills nearly one in three people who catch it. And as Dr. Fernando Gordia Altamirano says, we don't have as much info or treatments for it compared to the Zaire strain, and there's no vaccine for this one.
Antivirals that we have for other strains are not necessarily effective against this one. Same with vaccines that are in development, and same even with diagnostic tests.
So what does it mean for us here in Australia? Experts say the risk is low outside the African continent.
When Africa is affected, they are also at risk.
But Dr. Kaseya says Western countries like Australia shouldn't ignore it.
Because people are flying every day. And it means building strong system, supporting Africa, investing in Africa to have the local manufacturing of our vaccine and medicine is also the way to protect Western countries.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Shalila Madour reporting there, and yeah, we'll keep you up to date with any big developments when it comes to this Ebola outbreak.
Hack. We would rely on the drive there, we'd stop at a toilet nearby, and then that was sort of like the only stop we would get.
On Triple J.
Can you tell me about your toilet at work? Maybe you're thinking, what is there to tell? I don't think much about it. Probably because it hasn't been an issue. It's something that's just there. You don't have to think about. Well, for some workers, they actually can't find a toilet they can use at work, especially women on job sites, tradies in particular. We're hearing from you on the text line about this. Someone says, as a tradie, building sheds very rarely have a toilet. I have Crohn's disease, so it can get really interesting on some days. Another person saying, as a female police detective, often stuck at crime scenes for hours, having no access to a toilet. Got to beg for a toilet break on an overnight crime scene. Interesting stuff. We've been hearing a bit from you about this, and it's something that reporter Alice Angeloni's been looking into.
I walked out needing to go to the toilet, only to watch it being loaded onto the back of a truck.
Logan's an electrician from Launceston in Tasmania. She's in her 20s now, but memories of her time as an apprentice still haunt her.
In that moment, I realised there was no time to find someone to take me to a public toilet, and there was no other toilets on site, and I wet my pants. I was 17 years old.
Logan was working on a commercial site at the time.
I was very embarrassed and very scared as well. I walked off site and just sort of called my tradesman that was still on site and just sort of said what had happened, and we sorted a situation out to get me home and just change some pants.
Even though workplaces in Australia, including construction sites, must provide toilets, Logan reckons you'd be lucky to have a toilet and running water on site.
It's obviously an issue for everyone, but like, what's it like being a woman on a work site and getting your period and being at work?
Unless you're prepared, it's a bit of a nightmare.
Logan's not the only one.
Would spend 10 to 12 hour days out in these paddocks with no access to toilets, and I didn't have my truck license, so I couldn't just drive away.
Jasmine's also in her 20s and did a stint in civil construction where they'd work from rural spots around Tasmania.
Usually I would just wee behind the truck, which, I mean, I could handle that. It's not usually an issue, and I'm sure everyone's done that before, but it was just those unexpected moments that really cut me down.
Jasmine says at times she felt pretty vulnerable on site.
There were times where I was lucky I was wearing black pants because sometimes I would bleed through. It's pretty demoralising when you're working in those conditions and then having to spend the rest of the day in those same clothes and then sit in the truck on the way home. Same sanitary products.
This isn't just an issue in construction.
It was deeply disturbing to hear stories back from young, fit women who were putting themselves on the pill so they didn't even get their periods.
Last year, a survey from the Rail, Tram and Bus Union found 70% of female transport workers have suffered health issues because of inadequate toilet facilities. Leanne Holmes is the National Vice President.
One woman was even talking about thinking about having a hysterectomy because she loved her job so much, but she just could not deal with the stress and worry that she was going to have an accident or she couldn't have access to a clean toilet.
The survey found 4 in 5 women had resorted to dangerous or undignified coping strategies, which Leanne says isn't good enough.
Change this culture that exists where you've got bosses saying, well, this is just how it is in this workplace. You know, this is how it is on the railways because it's been like this for so long. Well, we're not going to cop that anymore.
Logan and Jasmine are trying to drive that change in their industry and others like emergency services too. They've started a business creating portable hygiene packs that contain sanitary items, disposal options and other essentials to support women on site.
Our, I guess, plan is just to try and prove that it is a necessary item. It's just like a first aid kit, and everyone has a first aid kit that's not even thought twice about. So something like this should be the exact same.
Jasmine reckons this should all be simple.
It's hard for young women to have that conversation with their bosses, so we just want to take away that awkwardness for young women to have to ask for something so simple. You don't feel awkward asking for a Band-Aid, so why should you feel awkward asking for something like this?
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there, and a lot of people asking, is this not the law? Like, what are the legal requirements? And it's true, yeah, it is. Under work health and safety laws, employers do need to provide clean, safe, accessible toilets. But doesn't appear to be happening all the time. We're hearing from you on the text line now. Someone's saying, I'm a tradesman. I got told off for putting a lock on the women's toilet and giving the only key to the woman in our crew because the guys wanted to use it. Women really have it tough for reasons most guys simply can't understand. Another one saying, I worked in a national retail store and was the only worker in the shop. When I asked, do I close the store to go to the bathroom? I was told I was not allowed to. I then asked what happens if I need to go to the bathroom, and they said, just don't drink water. Had to hold my bladder for up to 4 hours at a time. Wow. And another person, Jen, saying, I'm a fencing contractor. It's really hard to find somewhere to go to the toilet whilst wearing high vis. It's behind big trees if I'm lucky enough. Sometimes there are lovely people out there that let you use the bathroom, but new blocks are a different matter altogether. And someone else saying, there's actually a website, National Public Toilet Map. It's a free website and app that lets people plan ahead and find more than 25,000 toilets. Yeah, but you'd hope that on job sites you wouldn't need that. But hey, look, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.